All right, folks, welcome to Buckmaster's Outdoors Podcast. I've got a guy who's been with me for a long, long time and started from day one with me, Mr. Russell Thornberry. And Russell, welcome to the show. And
thank you, Jackie. I'm glad to be here.
I know we can go way back, but let's back it up because we're talking about 30-something years ago.
Well, I know it, how time flies. Huh?
And I was doing my first Buckmaster's Classic, and I was trying to find outdoor riders. You know, I had, you know, the Bo Jacksons and the Dale Earnhardts and all, and the celebrity end of it. And I had Buckmaster members who qualified. But then I was looking for the outdoor rider side of it and folks that were in the deer hunting that were notable and visible and stuff like that. And you were one of many riders that I noticed over the years. And I remember I called your wife, Charlene.
Yeah, yeah.
And asked for you and said, well, you weren't in or something, but I'd like to invite him to the Buckmasters. And she was going, what's that? And we were kind of telling her what it was. And you know, I think she told you, I bet if it wasn't for Charlene, you probably wouldn't have made the event. She told you to go.
So. Well, what happened was I came in from wherever I'd been, and she said this guy named Jackie Bushman called and wanted to invite you down to Alabama to a deer classic, you know, deer hunting in Alabama. And my first impression was, when is it? And she said, well, at the end of January. And I said, sign me up. It'll get me out of the... See, I'm living in Alberta.
Alberta.
That time of the year, anything south is an invitation you want to take. So
right.
I had no earthly idea what I was getting into.
And you probably still done.
Yeah, that's probably right.
And I was winging it. Remember, I was just a tennis professional coming into the outdoors with an outdoors event, which was... I set it up like the NBC Superstars event.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the old Joe Frazier used to be in track and field and, you know, and all that. So I just took the outdoor from knife throwing to hatchet throwing to skeet shooting and all that and just was trying to flip that concept that way.
Well, let me clue you on some things that you may not have ever been told that I experienced. First of all, I came down here, hadn't been in Alabama before. I'm Texan, married to a Canadian,
right.
Okay? So I came down, and it looked like it was going to rain. And, of course, being in the snow, I didn't think about that. So I went into this outdoor store to get a raincoat. And so I hear some guys talking about deer hunting. This is what he said. The clerk said, this guy, how's your season going? He says, oh, man. He said, it's a pits. And he said, well, what'd you get? He said, I only got 18. And I thought, 18 deer? You know, he's complaining. I live where one deer and you're out, brother.
I thought,
what am I into?
Yeah.
What in the world?
That's true. I think my best was 27 one year. So,
good.
But, I mean, you get a deer a day. I mean, you got a buck a day and then you had does. So.
I'm coming from a deer year, man.
I think if you did it every day and shot the limit, you could shoot 180.
I did the math and I just couldn't even believe it. And then, of course, when we got down to the classic, it was a blast. I mean, you guys treated me so well, but I didn't understand the terminology, number one, some of the hunting terminology that you guys used, and then I had a guy talking to me who I barely could understand anyway.
Must have had Jim Mason.
I had Elliot.
Oh, you had Elliot. Well,
and
all right, I'll put him with
you. He says, I'm going to carry you down to the swamp. And I said, you're going to carry me?
Yeah.
And I said, and what's the swamp? I didn't get the lingo, but he carried me, all right, in his big brown truck, and the swamp was where all the water was.
Oh, and we got it today as we speak.
I know it.
But, yeah, I mean, and I was just winging it. I sold a bunch of sponsors on an idea, and I needed to pull it off. And I never forgot old Bo Jackson. And he shot the biggest deer. We had all the experts there remembering.
Yeah.
There's old Bo Jackson doing what normally Bo Jackson does. He'll do it the biggest and the best. And I remember he shot that big 12-point, and I remember Dave put him up on a power pole.
Yeah.
And remember he was going up, and he looked in his rearview mirror driving off. He started coming down, and he came back and said, what are you doing, Bo? He said, I heard the electricity's up above it, and I'm coming down. So Bo come back about 12 foot, and then he said he had to go to the restroom. He said he was going to the restroom out of the tree stand. A big buck came out, so he is having a mess right there and ended up shooting the biggest deer. And
well, speaking of him, you know, he must have had hand coordination out of this world, because
the best of the best.
Some of us were out there, you know, shooting recurves and stuff and throwing those little round discs up, shooting them out of the air.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever had a bow in his hand. He walked up there and watched that, and he said, man, he said, could I try that?
Yeah,
sure, Bo. Hand him this recurve, throw that thing up in the air, and he nails it. And I go, all right.
He's a player. But I know that deer, and I say that deer right there is the first deer, dead deer, ever on the front page of the Birmingham News, and there's never been another one.
That's right. So, but what's in a name?
But
huh?
We got going there, you know, and that first event, the sponsor went, "Wow, that was cool." We got the publicity, and then we went from 5 sponsors to 20 sponsors, and then that's when I said, "Russell, we need a magazine."
Yeah,
and we need you to do that magazine. And
this is another funny thing. My whole life has been like this, and nothing you could ever plan. You said, could you put a magazine together? And I, of course, I had no idea how to do that, but I thought, well, how hard can it be?
Well, I remember after you said you'd take the job, you said, "Hey, you need to come up to Alberta and hunt with me."
Yeah.
And I forget whether that would have been November of 87 or 86, maybe.
Probably 86.
And I said, "All right." And I was sitting there looking at the weather patterns over the years, and 20, 30 below, and here's an old boy from Alabama that's, 25 or 30 above. It's pretty cold to us.
Yeah.
So you tried to get me prepared, and, you got me the clothes that you thought I needed, and I did that. But, my Lord, I have never been that cold in my life, and I always remembered that. And I remember I was freezing so bad, and all the catalog clothes I ordered, you said, "Here, take this vest right here, put it on, and that should help you through the day." And then I got through that, and then when I left, I said, "How about making me a whole suit out of that?" And little Susan Hembo started a little old business because of my little old southern cold butt. That's all I can say.
That's right.
But we got to hunting up there, and you had, which river was that up there?
The Battle River.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Eastern Alberta.
And, you'd been outfitting for years, and I think you averaged, 160 inches, which was phenomenal, for a lot of your hunters. But you were basically setting up on the opposite side of the river and kind of watching them with the wind right and sniping them kind of.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a phenomenal way to really see the big bucks. And I remember we were sitting up on the truck and you looked down there.
Yeah, we're on the top of the river,
top of the river,
all the way on top.
And we looked across and there this big buck stepped out.
Yeah.
And he said, "Jack, well, he's a long way, but the only way we'll have a chance at him is we got to go to the bottom down there and there's a tripod." And I think just going down was an adventure for me just to get there. So I remember I got in that tripod, but the problem was you couldn't get up there with me, so I was kind of on my own. And I remember we sat there for a minute, and all of a sudden this dope comes running out. And
I'm sitting under the tripod. I can't see anything.
Nothing. And here comes this big buck. Well, the thing is, I knew it was a big deer, but it was running sideways. I didn't know if it was the same buck that you and I saw up there that was facing us straight on.
Yeah.
And I kept going, "Can you see him?" You're going, "No, I can't see him. No, I can't. You're on your own." And I went, "All right, well, I hope I don't mess this up."
It was just before dark.
And I shot once, and I think that was a warning shot. And he stopped and looked at me, and I was fortunate to get another shell in. I shot again, and then I don't remember. He was gone.
Yeah.
And then
I said, "Did you get him?" "Well, I don't know.
I just didn't know." So we had to go to the river, which is the Battle River, and I'll never forget this for two things. That's the coldest I've ever been. We got to go across the river, Jack. And he said, "It could be the best cold you've ever felt or the worst cold you've ever felt." And by gosh, when that water went over my boots and in, I was frozen. I remember I got over on the other side, and I just started running around in circles to try to get my blood going. I was that cold.
Yeah.
And then we started looking for the deer, and I went to the right, and then you went to the left.
Well, yeah, and you were a nervous wreck too. Man, I hope I didn't shoot the wrong deer. I hope I shot the deer at all. Nothing was for certain, and you were looking over there, and I could tell you were worried. And oh my God! And so I'm looking, and I see the deer. And I see his antler sticking up, and I know you got the one you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, it was kind of cruel but funny. I said, "Well, Jackie, there's a dead deer over here." And you said, "Is it a goat?" And I wouldn't tell him.
You didn't tell me.
I said, "Well, I guess it just depends on what you call a goat." And "Well, it is. I said, "You got to come and look." And then you came over there and to say you were a happy man would be an understatement.
Understatement, because that deer right there is our logo buck. And I remember he had forked brow tines. I think he was 174-ish or 176, something like that. And I remember we had to take him back over on a ladder, if I remember right.
Yeah, we used it like a stretcher to carry him across.
Take him across and everything. And then I remember because Alan Bruin was with us, and you actually put him in the cabin next to the bathroom.
we didn't have a chance to take pictures that
night. I remember that. So you said we can't put him outside.
He's solid as a brick.
So we put him in front of the bathroom, and all the other hunters that hadn't shot were stepping over my deer to go to the bathroom.
That's right.
But then we got great pictures. I still got those. And like I said, that is where our logo came from.
Well, yeah, I know. And that was really exciting. And you're cold-blooded anyway, so it doesn't take us much to make you cold. Yeah. And some people don't understand, that the temperature sounds terrible. And, of course, it's cold. But it's a dry cold, so it doesn't bite you as bad. If it was that temperature down here, it would be no survival.
Oh, no survival.
But I'll just reveal this about you, about your cold-bloodedness. You figured out what to wear, but you also discovered those hand warmers.
Oh, my gosh.
And I want to tell the folks listening, if you hadn't seen Jackie come in from the cold hunting and start to undress, when he gets through, there's a knee-deep pile of hand warmers on the floor. You've had them every inch of your body.
And they kept me warm, and I put one on the back of my neck because I used to put ice in my bandana when I played tennis, and that kept me, cool. I put that there, and then I had a kidney belt. I still got it for 33 years, and I put them in there, and I'd stick them every other place.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny because everybody will see me in the airport, and I go, "Golly, you're a lot smaller in person." I said, "No, you're watching the Canadian show," because I look like the Michelin man.
Oh, I know.
But I did learn a lot how to dress from up there.
Yeah.
But that deer, where that deer dropped, didn't you say it's a ski resort now? There's a gondola there?
Yeah, there is a ski slope there. On that hill.
But that was a trip. That's where we started.
Yeah.
And I remember we wrote an article, and then you said, "Jackie, we're going to name this the What If Buck."
Yeah.
Because what if we wouldn't have gone up to the top? What if we wouldn't have done this?
Yeah.
What if you wouldn't have made the right decision? I mean, the name of the deer is the What If Buck.
Yeah.
And I want you to write the story as you see it.
Right.
And a feature story for folks out there listening is 2,500 or 3,500 words, whatever, right?
Yeah, about 25 was
2,500. So I got to writing, and I finally finished it, and I turned it over to Russell, and he went, "Wow,
is that awesome?
We got a problem here. You hadn't left the Montgomery Airport, and you've already got 2,500 words. You wrote a 6,000 word, basically the whole magazine was this story." And you asked me, you said, "Look, I'll fix this thing. It'll be right, but you got to promise me one thing." I said, "Well, what's that?" You said, "If you will never write in this magazine again, I will write and take care of this magazine." And that was a promise I kept.
And I just appreciate that.
And I did. But that was, I was excited about writing the story, but I just remember in my English days, my English professor kept saying redundant. There was more red marks on it. So I got a C because they like to come watch the tennis matches. It's the only thing I can remember at all. But I remember that. That was the way we got this whole thing started in the magazine. And boy,
well, I went home, backing up a bit to the classic. And Charlene said, "Well, do you have a good time?" I said, "Man, it was a blast." I said, "Not only was it warm, but these guys are so hospitable, and the food's out of sight." And then next week, when I had no idea going in what was coming, and when you called me and wanted to know about doing a magazine, it was like, whoa, what in the world?
Yep, and we're still plugging at it. So 1987 was the first Buckmasters magazine, and now 33 years later, we're still plugging at it.
We got a few more wrinkles and gray hairs and missing hair.
And that's what I was saying. That getting 35 foot up that tree, at my age now, I still enjoy it, but I'm sure mighty glad that the folks at Hunter Safety System got me something to hook me up from the top to bottom.
Isn't that the truth? Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm starting to get real happy about ground blind.
Oh, I was going to say, I like a ground blind hunt, but I still enjoy it. I still have the passion, and you do too. And then that's the thing. You either love the hunting or you don't love the hunting. And I've just seen so many changes. And, there was something that you wrote, and I've got it right in front of me. It's about the biblical side of hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got so many people that are trying to take our sport away from all the animal rights groups and stuff like that really don't understand what hunting and the hunting conservation is about. Because we all know, if it wasn't for the hunter and the fisherman, we wouldn't have the abundant wildlife that we have.
We proved that because we nearly lost it all.
Exactly. But I think when you have the man upstairs reference it in the number one book, the Bible,
right,
I think that cuts right through it. And you wrote a great article on that. I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, this was back when the PETA's campaign was posting a thing that said Jesus is a vegetarian and all this. And the anti-hunting segment of the culture, plus the emphasis that against hunting from some of these organizations, has poisoned the pond, so to speak. Sure. And people that are, you know, God-fearing people, I trust that, but they bought into this and actually believed it, and the Bible doesn't support that in any way. And so the idea, and a lot, you know, in the commandments is shalt not kill. Well, they say, you know, then you can't be a Christian because you're killing something. And they don't understand what he's talking about is murder of another human.
Yes.
You know, so if it says don't murder another human, that makes pretty good sense.
Right.
But the problem is that Jesus ate meat.
Yeah.
Jesus ate fish and shared it with other people. And so basically what I was trying to do was combat biblical ignorance. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to change an anti-hunter's mind, because usually it's a case of trying to have a rational conversation with an irrational soul. But Christians that believe that need to know that don't take a biblical stand out of ignorance that's actually counter to what the Bible says, okay?
Right.
And so, excuse me, in the Passover, lamb was the common thing that they ate. Jesus, after the resurrection, meets his Peter and the disciples on they're out fishing there, and they don't recognize Jesus, but basically he's got his little fire going. He says, hey guys, come on in here and put your fish on the fire with mine. You know, it's like, so, you know, you don't eat a live fish. So apparently they killed him first.
Exactly.
And so it is to make a sort of a Reader's Digest version of what was a fairly long article, which, by the way, I'm sure is still on file here. If somebody wants to read this, they can. I mean, we can make it available to them.
Right.
But it explains in great detail, scripture by scripture, the things that prove this wrong. Now, having said that, PETA is their stock and trade is campaigning on big lies, mm-hmm. You know. So that's to be expected from them. But I'm disappointed that Christians that don't know their Bible well enough,
right,
to be able to spot a lie when they see it. That's dangerous.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at this. I remember Genesis 1:28. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground."
Yeah.
That is God's word of conservation.
That is exactly right.
Right there. That nails it right there. Because otherwise, he wouldn't make the wildlife there.
That's right. Well, basically, he says, I'm going to put you in charge of the taking care of this planet.
Yes.
And, you know, you and I know, because we've seen it, and other people see it but don't realize it. If I'm a rancher and I've got a carrying capacity of my land is 100 cows, if I don't take some of them out pretty soon, they're all going to starve to death because the land can't carry them. Well, that's the same's true of wildlife.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, that is, like I said, I've got this article I looked at, and there's, I don't know, you've got over a dozen biblical references to hunters, hunting, and everything. But I always like the Genesis 1:28 because that was God's word of a conservation.
That is right. That's exactly right.
The truth is the truth.
Yeah.
So, in your kind of retired age right now, you've been making bows by hand. You've been making knives by hand.
What has
got you into all of that part of
well,
it? The primitive side of the sport? You just going back to the roots of it?
Well, I guess what happens is the older I get, the better I like old stuff.
Yeah.
And so I got fascinated, you know, even as a kid growing up in South Texas and messing. I was out crawling around the brush all the time, and I would find an artifact like an addle point or a stone, you know, a flint point. And usually I found it when I was hunting. Mm-hmm. And when I found that point, I was so excited that whatever I was hunting just became the safest animal in the world. I'm looking at the ground,
right.
And it just fascinated me. And then one day, Later in life, I picked up a real pretty point down in northern Mexico when we were filming. Mm-hmm. And I, for some reason, that day I thought, I got to figure out how they did this. Well, that wasn't quite as simple as I thought, because just like there's a lot of modern flint knappers, but they're not in the Yellow Pages.
Right.
But they are a brotherhood, and if you find one, you'll connect with all of them before it's over. And so I got this idea. My first thought was, this point is perfect. What I need to do is put it on a shaft and go hunting with it and complete the job that whoever this was that made it started. Yeah. Well, in the process, I thought, I'm going to need a bow. So I was living in Alabama, of course, and I thought, well, I want to see how the Cherokees, you know, did what they did. And then I found out that the Bodark was a great... So I started on this making a self bow out of Bodark. And so I thought, well, no, I won't just shoot the point. I'll make my own point, make my own bow, make me a river cane arrow like in antiquity. And so this whole process took me 2 years before I could make anything worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Went down to Mexico and shot a buck and a doe and a javelina with this primitive stuff. And here's, you know, like I was in a ground blind made out of every thorn bush in Mexico. And this buck walked by at 3 yards. And I'm in there in a ghillie suit. And I'm holding this longbow, I'm holding, and when I saw that buck was going to come that close, I looked up and the tip of that bow was going like this.
Yeah.
It was like it was being struck by lightning. It was the most exciting thing. And so basically, to summarize, I have come to the place that it's not if I do it, but how I do it.
Right.
So that's what trips my trigger. And it drags me into the process of flint knapping, of making, you know, hand-making self bows, arrows, and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of like tying your own trout flies. It's just another dimension of involvement. And I found out something real quick. You know, I thought, well, I want to do this like the primitive guys did. Well, what I found out after the fact was the primitive guys weren't doing this for sport.
No.
It was a very serious business to survive.
Right.
And that's why the hunting parties,
yes,
that means a whole bunch of guys, like there's still hope while there's arrows in the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A whole lot different than one guy trying to go out and get supper. So it was a joint effort, but I just like it. It gives me something to do, you know, like I need something else to do. But I really enjoy that. I get a lot of satisfaction out of it. And, you know, when I started flint knapping and making points and stone knives and stuff like that, I was just trying to see if I could do it.
Right.
And then somebody come along and say, well, could I buy that? And I'd never thought of that. In any kind of way, it turned into a little hobby business that, you know, I enjoy it.
Well, I mean, you know, to take something from scratch and build a weapon that actually takes an animal like the guys did way back.
Yeah.
And now you see, you got, you know, bows and arrows and stuff like that, and now you got crossbows that shoot over 400 feet per second. The technology has come a long way, but you went backwards.
Well, I you know, I think I did what everybody, I mean, been on the history of it all. I've been here long enough to go from when everybody shot recurves or longbows. Then the compound came in, it was like, wow, you know, and I was in the front of the line.
Sure.
And I used all the fancy new technology and loved every minute of it, and I'm not mad at it yet.
No.
I still got a compound bow if I want to use it. My wife has a crossbow.
Right.
She's deadly.
Yeah.
But it's just like it keeps me involved in the sport kind of year round.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I'm getting ready a lot more than I'm getting hunting.
Well, that's awesome. You know, and I look back, you know, you and I were together for many years. And as I said, what we were trying to do, and I'm still trying to do it, you're trying to do it in your retirement, is to explain a sport to the non-hunters out there to try to understand why we do what we do.
Yeah.
Because we're only 10% of the population. The animal rights are 10%, but 80% of the folks are the non-hunters who will never hunt. We would love for them to experience, but
They're the ones that make a decision on whether we get to continue.
Exactly.
So you have to give an honest influence for consideration.
Yeah, and I just think that article about, you know, the biblical side of it can touch a lot of people to understand if, you know, if God wanted us to do this and provide us the animals and that, I don't think it comes any higher than that.
No, so. I don't think so either. My hope is that people will just understand, measure what's being said. If they're going to take a biblical stand, then you ought to know what the Bible says.
Exactly. Well, I look back. I was trying to think of one trip because we took a lot of trips. But, for some reason, I don't know why, I was always the brunt of the jokes. And, I'm known nationwide. I can go to a restaurant. I can walk down a beach. I can do anything. And people walk up to me, and I am the guy that's afraid of snakes.
Boy, you ain't kidding.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you're a marked man.
I'm just marked. I don't care what camp, but I mean, I remember that's the only sponsor that I ever gave the money back on was the snake chap guys, and they made me have rattlesnakes bite me. But everywhere I went, that was set up for a snake jump.
Oh, sure.
So everybody got me. But it's funny, they didn't talk about a big deer I shot or this or that. They just walk up, snake. So,
yeah, oh, I know.
But I remember you and I was trying to think back. We went to Idaho.
Oh, yeah, my favorite hunt with you.
And you set me up like you ain't never set up anybody.
Well, if the listener doesn't know this tradition, is if you miss a deer, I don't care with a bow or a rifle, back in we're hunting camp, family camps and all that. Well, you get your shirt tail cut off.
That's right.
And so
kangaroo courts, what we call it here in the South.
Exactly. And so I was with the guide, and we're going along on a four wheeler, and out in the middle of absolutely nowhere, there's this fabulous apple tree. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Stop! Stop! I want to go look." And man, the deer been under there eating those apples. And I said,
middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and I said, "I don't know where you plan on taking me, but this is where I stop."
Right.
And I got in a tree, 20 yards.
Yeah.
And sure enough, that evening, this fine buck comes in. And I remember when I drew my arrow, I thought, this isn't even a challenge.
Right.
I just happened to be looking at the wrong pin.
Yeah.
And I shot under that sucker, and I thought, Russell, you are a real dummy. And so, naturally I confessed, and then at the end of the show, I got wind that for closers, you were going to cut my shirt tail
Absolutely.
Off.
You missed.
You missed
on national television.
That's right. Going to humiliate me in front of the whole world. And so while you weren't looking, I went over and got one of your fancy button-up
brand new
camo shirts and put it on. And I remember when I walked in there, we were getting ready to film, and you said, "You gonna wear that?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I want to look nice for the closing." You had no idea it was your shirt, and so I stood there and let you go through all the deal. And well, you know how it is, Russell.
Yep.
And you cut the whole shirt tail off, and then
I said, a little bit. I cut over
half
you
of the
back.
The shirt.
I took out the whole shirt.
And it was with great glee that I said, "Well, Jackie, I guess I should have told you I'm wearing your shirt."
You burnt me on that one.
Oh, but that was funny. We had fun. Golly.
Yeah, we did. And I think that's what you got to look at, the sport, is do you have fun in camp? I remember we went to Montana one time, and you were pretty good at improvising and putting up tree stands and stuff like that. And we kept seeing this deer. And we had a stand, what they call Jackie stand, where I shot my first deer. And I remember the first time we went out, and you hadn't done video. You'd been shooting deer.
Yeah.
And I first started, it was like the famous two words of a cameraman was don't shoot.
Yeah.
Because the cameras weren't good enough.
Yeah, exactly. And well, the old days, the way the cameras were built, they couldn't
draw the light.
It got dim or a little dusky, and we could see. It's still legal, and those old cameras couldn't work.
I had a 170-inch deer under me at 10 yards. And even I could make that shot, but don't shoot. And that was the name of the tree stand was don't shoot.
The don't shoot thing.
And then I remember you were there, and you kept seeing this deer from my stand going by this tree that was bent over, going to eat on these leaves.
Yeah.
And we're coming down the end, and we really needed this deer on camera.
Yeah.
And you went, the only way we're going to shoot this deer is y'all got to go get the step ladder. And let me climb the stepladder on that bend of the tree.
Yeah, it was a big cottonwood.
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably 5 feet in diameter.
Yeah, it was big.
And it came out of the ground at a 45-degree angle where you could not put a conventional stand.
No.
And it went up at about, 25 feet of elevation on this 45-degree angle. Then it branched straight up into like three big limbs going vertical. We're like a little crow's nest where you could, if you got up there, you could stand 1 foot on the other and wait. And so,
but we couldn't put the cameraman. The cameraman had, to
be in your stand,
in my stand, and try to watch you. Try to shoot a deer from the. From the tree that you already pulled the ladder out.
Oh, yeah. He put me up there in the dark.
And pulled the ladder
out. And that was the deal, though. Take the ladder and lay it down somewhere. Yeah. And so and the deer was bedding on an island in the river out there. But in the fall, when the water was low, he could walk from that island, which was just like dog hair brush on there. He could walk across on dry ground. At night, go up on top of the river valley and eat sugar beets all night.
Yep.
And then on his way back, he'd stop under this little whatever kind of tree it was. You could tell he'd been wearing it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, it was the only way I could see to do it. So anyway, I get up there and wait, and pretty soon here he comes. Mm. I thought, my goodness. And so I shot him with my bow.
Yeah, you did.
And,
that's 160 class deer.
Oh, yeah. It was one of the best deer I've ever killed with a bow. But the problem was that you bunch of turkeys wouldn't bring the ladder to get me down so I could go see it, because it ran out of sight. And y'all have been like, oh, man, is that not? Oh, I said, please let me go see the deer. Finally, they bring the ladder and let me down.
Well, that just goes to show you, you just got to keep thinking out of the box. And you thought out of the box on that one pretty good, because
well,
that deer kept going under that tree. He kept going under that tree.
And, you know, there wasn't any way that you could hunt him out of a tree like you normally do.
Yeah.
But I guess what happened to me was that all my years in the outfitting business, I'm trying to figure out scenarios one way or another all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if it's a good deer, there's got to be a way. It may not be.
Yeah.
But as you well know, in TV, you're limited somewhat to how adventurous you can be.
And these cameras, they've gotten better.
They've gotten
where I can't see it and the camera can, and that's the complete opposite of what it used to be. But back in those old days, when I first started, I was going, now I know why nobody's ever done a whitetail show.
Yeah.
You can't get them on camera.
Yeah.
I ended up doing most of them in Texas because they just walked around and said, shoot me.
That's right.
But the Alabama, the Canadians, and the other ones, it was tough.
But
you and I have come a long way, and I just want to say thank you for all the work you did for Buckmasters over the years, and I just wish you the best in your retirement. Now you're a great-grandfather, and you're making bows and knives and all that. So I just hope it's what you want it to be in the later part of life, and I just want to be there with you here pretty soon.
Well, I'll tell you, it's I have been blessed. I got to do things that I couldn't dream of that were right in my wheelhouse, you know, the things that I love. So God's been good to me. I'm doing something I swore I'd never do. I'm a pastor now in my old age.
And you're doing a great job.
Charlene and I pastor a little church out in the foothill of the Alberta Rockies and enjoying it immensely, which I never thought I would. So you never say never.
Never say never. All right, folks, that does it for today's Buckmasters Outdoors podcast with my buddy Russell Thornberry, who started the Buckmasters Whitetail magazine many years ago. And we've just been real blessed to be friends, and we've had a lot of fun. And as I said, it's a great sport, and you've used this sport to the max. And I have too, but we're going to keep doing it. That's the way I look at it.
You had a dream. You wanted to do something that nobody had done. And, you know, sometimes the less you know, the better you are off you are when you start admitting. If we knew starting some of the things, we'd have never done it. But, you know, ignorance was bliss, and we wanted to do it, and it worked.
And it worked. All right, folks, that does it for today.